You'll want to keep your Bibles open to Isaiah 59, because this morning we're going to talk about hope. What does it look like to live with hope in Jesus? And this is the question we're wrestling with. And I know that last week I talked a little bit about my personality. And I want to say something else, because hope is commonly mistaken for being positive or optimistic, which are my default settings. And so I want to tell you a quick story. Earlier this week, I was driving in a car with Jacob, who is a pastor here in town, and he's a friend of mine, and we were talking. We had just finished two full days of presentations in local middle school classrooms. And I know some of you know this, but some of you may not know this. But over the last 3 years, Jacob and I have been developing a program to help support middle school students with their social and their emotional health needs. And so up until this year, we've only been in sixth grade classrooms. And overwhelmingly, over the last 2 years, sixth graders have really connected with our presentation. It's gone over really well. Teachers have appreciated it. But this week, we were driving away from the school. As we were driving away from the school, we had just finished our first presentations with seventh graders. And we were both a little bit blown away at how big of a gap there is, how big of a distance there is. Whitney's going like this. She taught seventh grade math for a little while. There's a jump. And the seventh graders were a much harder group. And so we were starting to process how it went together. And overall, we both felt good about it. It was a good day. And sort of just to add to the good feelings, because I like to do that, I told Jacob a couple of stories about some students and some things that some students had said that showed that they were really excited that we were there. Like, there was this one kid in the back of the room who at one point I heard him go, "I love these guys." So I took note and remembered and told Jacob. And as I was telling him the second story, Jacob asks me, "Why don't I hear any of the kids say good stuff about us?" And I joked with him. I was like, "Well, maybe it's my personality. Maybe I'm listening for it." He's like, "Maybe it's your personality and you're just making it up." which made us both laugh. And as we were still laughing, while we were still laughing, Jane called me on the phone. I'm driving, so we answer on speakerphone. And not knowing that Jacob is with me, Jane asked how the day went. She knew I was a little bit apprehensive about the day. And so I told her what Jacob and I had already said, that it went really well, that it was a good day. And do you know what she asked me? "Does Jacob feel the same way?" So Jacob and I both start laughing together. Within a minute, two people who know me really well, two people who also are not naturally overly optimistic or overly positive, experienced my positivity and questioned it. Right? Was I seeing things correctly? Or was my personality affecting my view of reality? These are actually really fair questions. Because if hope is anything, if hope has any value, it has to be connected to reality. It has to be grounded in reality. And so I want you to know I wasn't offended by their questions, and they didn't make me any less positive. In fact, in that moment, I felt both known and seen, right, by my wife and by my friend. They know me, and they wanted to make sure that I wasn't getting in the way of the truth. The reason I started this morning with this story is because people like me, people who are overly positive and optimistic, often confuse positivity and optimism with biblical hope. We're good at telling people to hope for the best, or that success is just based on believing the best about yourself. And there are a million cliches that we use to say the same thing. Think positive thoughts, wish for the best, and this is how to hope. At least that's what, you know, my people will tell you. But it turns out that actually we're not alone. That it seems that people who tend toward negativity or pessimism actually often believe the same sort of thing about hope, because they've heard the cliches too, and they think that hope is out of reach for them. They know that maybe they tend to think more negatively. They know that they tend to maybe be a pessimist. And so they think that if they just thought more like the optimist, then they would have hope too. But the problem with this is simple. There are plenty of pessimistic people who are deeply hopeful. The biblical prophets are example A. In fact, the passage we just read a minute ago, Isaiah 59 is part of the last section of the book of Isaiah. And Isaiah is considered maybe one of the most or the more optimistic of the prophets. And this final section of his book is actually considered the most optimistic section of the whole book as a whole. And yet this passage has a dark pessimism about people. But at the same time, it radiates a shining hope toward God. If you're struggling to imagine that an optimist might lack true hope, or that a pessimist might possibly be a model of hope, then you've confused categories, which is easy to do because we easily mix these categories up. But optimism is not the same as hope, and pessimism is not the opposite of hope, at least not the way the Bible talks about hope. And so I hope to look at our passage this morning and say some things and reflect a bit on what it means for Advent hope to shape us into a hopeful people. To do that, let's jump right into the middle of Isaiah, Isaiah 59. So we'll start at verse 9. And if you'd follow along with me, starting in the middle of verse 9, we read, "We hope for light and behold darkness, and for brightness, but we walk in gloom. We grope for the wall like the blind. We grope like those who have no eyes. We stumble at noon as in the twilight. Among those in full vigor, we are like dead men. We all growl like bears. We moan and moan like doves. We hope for justice, but there is none. For salvation, but it is far from us." This passage says something about the hope that the Israelites are experiencing. Isaiah starts with a metaphor, but then at the end, he gets really specific. The people hope for metaphorical light, right? They hope for brightness. But what is this light that they're looking for? What form does this brightness have in their lives and in the world? Well, verse 11 then makes it explicit. Justice is what light looks like. Salvation is what brightness looks like. These are the things that the people are looking for. Justice and salvation, it's what they're longing for. This is where their hope is, for justice and salvation. But Isaiah tells us that these are nowhere to be found. There is only metaphorical darkness and gloom. There is no justice. Salvation is far away. And Isaiah describes what this is like for the people, what the experience is like to hope for something so seemingly impossible. And so if you look at verse 10, you hear Isaiah describing the people groping for the wall as if blind. You picture this. Or Isaiah wants us to imagine someone wandering around, stumbling in the middle of the day as though it were still night. So the first time I ever ran in the darkness was with David. David had a headlamp, and I did not have a headlamp, and I ate it. Went down pretty good. Jay has somehow convinced me to start running in the dark. Also, still don't have a headlamp, so this is probably just really dumb. But I have discovered that I run like leaping. Like, I don't want my feet to like trip. Like, I don't want to, you know, hook my foot on anything. And so I'm like leaping like a gazelle. It's dumb. It looks really stupid. I can tell with every step. But the point, take from that what you will, the point is that when it's dark, we move through the world differently than when it's light. Isaiah is asking us to imagine people walking around in the middle of the day as if it were night. We can visualize this, right? Or even more vivid, Isaiah gives us before zombies were cool in our culture, zombies. He's describing people who are walking around as if they are dead, right in the middle of people who are fully alive. Can you picture it? It's just like people walking around. Like this, he's giving us these images for people who have hope, but their hope is broken, misdirected, misguided. There's something wrong with their hope. There's something not quite right about this hope. And so it's not enough to just say hope because they're hoping. So the question is their hope just simply unfulfilled, right? Is it that they've been hoping for a long time and the stuff just isn't coming to pass? Is it that it's taking too long for God to act? Is it that they are starting to lose faith? Chapter 59 opens with what sounds like a response to the Israelites' concerns. So if you can imagine all of 59 as a word from the Lord addressing their concerns, they are looking for justice and salvation, and they've begun to question whether God can come through for them. Can God bring this thing that we are longing for? And verse 1 announces, "Behold, the Lord's hand is not shortened, that it cannot save, or his ear dull, that he cannot hear." So it would seem that in the people's unfulfilled hope, they've begun to blame God. Why isn't God responding? The Lord's hand must be too short. Okay, this is a pretty great image, right? My go-to image is, have you ever seen the skit where somebody stands and then somebody comes up behind them and puts their arms through and they have to like make food or like feed the person, like their arms through the person can't quite do it. And so it's pretty hilarious. The idea being that somehow God's arm is shortened, and so God can't save us. Or the Lord's ear must be dull. Can you imagine offering this kind of accusation to God, right? Well, God can't hear us. Therefore, something must be wrong with God's ear. Because as the people decide, if God could hear us, God would act. If God could save us, God would save us. The people have put their hope in God, but God is apparently letting them down. At least that's how they see it. Isaiah is here to free them from their mistaken perspective. Isaiah begins to tell them that their hope is futile. I titled this morning's sermon, "Futile Hope." And then discovered that futile is actually one of Becca's vocabulary words for school. And so I just said, "So what does it mean?" And she said, "Hopeless." And I was like, perfect. There are other words that you could use to define futile, but this seems pretty good for us this morning. Hopeless hope. Before we look at what Isaiah has to say, I thought I'd give you a definition of futile hope and then offer an example, and then we'll jump into it. But futile hope, hopeless hope, is hope with no basis for hope. And probably the most common kind of cause of futile hope is when we actively work against the thing that we're hoping for. For example, how many of you have ever said or heard your child say or heard someone say, "I hope I get a good grade on a test"? You don't have to raise. I see some teachers with hands raised, see some parents nodding heads. Okay, yeah. And then have you or somebody else ever followed up with the question, "Did you study for it? Or did you get a good night's sleep the night before the test? Or breakfast?" There's another good question. "Or have you been doing your homework?" Right? Hoping to get a good grade on a test you didn't study for, that you haven't done work for, that you aren't physically ready for, is hope with no basis for hope. Like it's a wish that a superhero might heroically swoop in and do something for you that you do not deserve, that you have not earned. This is exactly what's happening with the Israelites. See, they are devastated. They have, at this point in Isaiah, come back from exile. The end of exile has been announced, and they are rebuilding their temple, and they are reestablishing themselves in the land, and there is a new beginning underway. These are all of the things that God promised would happen, but something is terribly wrong. Something hasn't happened yet that they've longed for, that's been at the sort of center of this hope. See, Israel has been unable to reestablish the king or their kingdom, to declare their independence. And so Israel has continued to be under the thumb of the Persians and of the Greeks. And the Israelites have suffered under these foreign empires. And so the Israelites are just, they're pleading for justice. Their deepest hope is that God would come and save them, rescue them from these enemy occupiers. And anyone might wonder, what is God up to? But Isaiah lays out a case against the people, and we heard it read earlier by Tom, but I think it's worth hearing parts of it again. And notice as you listen to some of this, the "you" language starting in verse 2, directed to the Israelites, these people who are hoping for justice and hoping for salvation. So starting in verse 2, we read, "But your iniquities, your sins have made a separation between you and your God. Your sins have hidden his face from you so that he does not hear." Right? Isaiah is already clarifying their complaint. God's hand is not too short to act. These people should know better than anybody that God's hand is mighty to save. The people have separated themselves from their God. He's not listening to them because of how deeply they continue to sin against each other and against him. Listen to what they're doing to each other. Starting in verse 3, "For your hands are defiled with blood, your fingers with iniquity. Your lips have spoken lies. Your tongue mutters wickedness. No one enters suit justly. No one goes to law honestly. They rely on empty pleas. They speak lies. They conceive mischief and give birth to iniquity." Jumping down to verse 7, we read that their feet run to evil and they are swift to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are thoughts of iniquity. Desolation and destruction are in the highways. The way of peace they do not know, and there is no justice in their paths. They have made their roads crooked. No one who treads on them knows peace. I think when we read these, if we can really hear them, I think we'd see that some of the hoping that happens in our world today, even in the church, is connected to lives that are engaged in this kind of rebellion against God. Can you hear what Isaiah is saying? These are accusations. These are God's accusations against God's own people. You, they, right? Their lives are filled with sin and wickedness. But more specifically, in verse 8, we're told that there is no justice in their paths. This is a metaphor. The path is the place you walk on. It's where you live. And so this means that the people, they do not walk in justice. Justice is not a part of their lives. It's not a priority. It's not a habit. They could care less about offering each other justice or about being a just people. And so it shouldn't surprise us to hear the people speak then about themselves. The pronouns change from you and they to we and us. In verse 9, we basically pick up with them acknowledging we haven't cared about justice, therefore justice is far from us and righteousness does not overtake us. And then as we read earlier, they hope for justice, but find none. Can you hear the accusation that's being made? They are hoping for something. The very thing that they are actively working against in their own lives. Their hope is futile. Let me just run through some examples. If you were a boss and you had a company and you're the kind of boss who never says thank you to your employees, right? You can't just hope that your employees will be satisfied and will turn around and be thankful for what you've done for them. If you're the kind of person who resists or won't go to premarital counseling or won't do any like reading or real work to be a better husband or wife, you can't just hope to have a good marriage. Don't be surprised when your marriage suffers. I recently heard some folks talking about who've lived in Livermore for a long time. And they were talking about how, like, you know, they raised their kids here and they were just lamenting that their kids can't afford to live here. But then they started talking about how Livermore is just building too many houses and someone's got to put a stop to it. And they couldn't in that moment see that their desire to keep Livermore exactly as it was when they moved here is actually one of the reasons why their kids can't afford to live here now. So they hope for this thing that they're actively working against. Like, we could go on and on. There are so many examples of ways that we hope for something that we actively work against. The church in our culture has hoped to win people to Christ, while the church has done often a poor job of living out the character of Christ in compelling ways. Futile hope is everywhere. In fact, Isaiah seems to me to be making the case that human beings are masters of hoping for things that we have no basis to hope for. Or at least that human beings are masters of working against ourselves for the very things that we want and we need. And so Isaiah tells us what God might do for people who are masters at working against themselves. In verse 15, we learn that the Lord saw it. This is the end of verse 15. The Lord saw it, right? Saw the people and their sin, and it displeased him. The Hebrew says it was evil in his eyes. He goes on that there was no justice. He saw that there was no man and wondered that there was no one to intercede. He saw that there was no man. In other words, God made humanity, male and female, no man. The word for man is the general broad term for humanity. Saw that there was no human. Think about this. God made humanity, male and female, to rule and to govern the world that he made, to rule it with righteousness and justice. When his project has broken apart and has fallen apart, and God shows up and he calls Abraham and he says, through you, I'm going to bless and restore the whole thing. I'm going to bring peace to this thing. What does he say? I've chosen you and your people so that you would keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice. Justice is the very thing that God's people are supposed to hope for. It's actually the thing that we were made to do. Justice is the very thing that God's people are supposed to be doing in the world. But we discover there was no justice among God's people, and God saw that there was no one truly human among his people. There's no one doing what humans were made to do. That if we are actually not living out God's creation purpose and intention for us, we are living as less than human. There was no one, male or female, doing what God made them to do. No one doing justice. Who could then intercede. In other words, who could then cry out with integrity for more justice? And we're told that God wondered if there was anyone who could. Pessimists, here's your day in the spotlight. Is there any human being anywhere in the world who can intercede? The answer is no. So what is God to do when he looks around and he can't find anyone capable of doing the things that human beings were made to do? When human beings were made to keep the world running and operating and going forward with love and joy and justice. And so you keep reading in verse 16. Verse 16, we hear what God is going to do. Then his own arm brought him salvation, and his righteousness upheld him. The Lord's arm isn't too short. This is good news. God himself is going to act. And verse 20 gives us the explicit statement about what is going to happen, and it is that a redeemer will come to Zion. This will be God's answer, that a human will come, a human will bring justice, a human will then be able to intercede, calling for more justice. This is the hope of Advent, that God looks at us. This doesn't sound super hopeful if all you can think of hope is optimism and positivity, but God looks lovingly at human beings. That's what this season of Advent is about, God looking at us and hearing our desperate cries and seeing people who have completely destroyed the image of God in themselves and in each other. What he sees and hears are people who have marred his beauty, who have polluted his holiness, who have corrupted his character, who have abused his power. We want justice for ourselves, but we don't want justice for our neighbors. We want security for ourselves, but we don't want security for our neighbors. We want love for ourselves, but we don't want love for our enemies. Our hearts have been darkened. They have been hardened. They have been closed. And then we have the nerve to turn around and blame God for not giving us what we want or what we need. And as he looks on us lovingly, he discovers that we are lost, completely and utterly lost. There is none. There is no human being who is righteous. And so God promises the impossible. We have no basis within ourselves to hope for God to save us. In every way, we work against our own salvation. The Gospels tell the story. Jesus will come, God in the flesh, God with us, Emmanuel, and he will stand before women and men and he will offer to them life. He will offer them salvation and justice. He will offer them deliverance for them for their sins, and they will kill him. That's what we do when salvation presents itself to us. This is who we are. It's dark, pessimistic, but I think it's true. And it's not just me. Our tradition has taught us that our utter depravity, our sin, has stolen our humanity from us. And the longer we remain disconnected from God in our sin, the less human we become. And yet, a Redeemer will come to Zion. A Redeemer who will offer us life and salvation, but who will be killed by us, and who somehow turns that death into the means of breaking through our hard hearts, of enabling us to have our hearts softened and moved, to receive a new heart and a new spirit, somehow seeing our salvation crucified for us, by us, breaks us in a way that people have been trying to explain for 2,000 years. But if you know what it's like to receive a new heart from God, if you know what it's like to receive his Holy Spirit, you might not be able to explain how it happens, but you can testify. A sinner like me, once hard-hearted, somehow has had my heart overcome by love. Advent reminds us that God came to his sinful, rebellious people, and he promised that he would deliver them. He would bring justice. He would bring them salvation. Our Advent hope is nothing like optimism. Right? There is nothing to be optimistic about when we look at sin and its power to destroy, and when we look at how readily we are tempted and lured by sin. There is no reason. The scriptures give us a comprehensive testimony to this truth. There is no reason for us to be positive or optimistic about human possibilities or potential when humans are ruled by sin and when we wield sin as a weapon. For us, there is only one basis for hope. the God who makes promises. The God who continues to keep them from the beginning until now, until the day when he returns. There is no reason why we should receive justice and salvation except that's who God is. He has declared this future for us. And he is good, and he is faithful, and he is love, and he is able to do more than we could ever hope or imagine. Advent, this season, is a chance for us to turn ourselves away from human potential and human possibilities, and instead fix our eyes on the potential and possibilities that exist in the God who made all things, who holds all things together, who offered his very life for us, and who even today continues to sustain us. It's in him alone that we live and move and have our being. And so let us fix our eyes on him.